Welcome to the Bereans Lab. We're studying the subject of Christian ethics. And specifically, we're giving attention to work and wealth. Oftentimes, we think of ethics in terms of poverty, but really the ethics have to do with wealth. What we who have wealth do with it, and how we view work. And we're in the second installment on that particular subtopic. Some of you are aware of Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life. I was not aware of how absolutely phenomenal the popularity of that book has been. It's, apart from the Bible, it is the most widely translated book in the world, in history. Yes. There's no other text other than the Bible that's been translated into more languages than this book. It had a phenomenal impact, which was way beyond the author's expectations. But the book has become famous because of its the first line in the book. It's not all about you, or it's not about you. And of course, that's his point. And it's not about your neighbor either. It's not about your relationship with your neighbor. It's really about God's purpose for your life through a relationship with Christ. And what he does is talks in this book about five aspects of how to find or what is the purpose in a person's life, given the revelation that has come to the world through Christ. What I want to do is talk not about the purpose-driven life, but the purpose of wealth, or the purpose-driven wealth. What do we do with the stuff that God has given us? And how is our responsibility to Christ reflected in how we relate to the things that are under our stewardship? By way of review, we started last week by looking at the 12th chapter of John, the story of the anointing of Jesus' feet by Mary with this costly perfume worth a year's salary. And Judas being upset because he was not going to be able to pilfer this from the treasury and use the excuse that it could have gone to the poor. Well, in that passage, you'll remember, there are three applications of wealth that form a framework for a discussion. One, selfish consumption. Two, social compassion. And finally, foot washing. Mary's washing Jesus' feet with this costly jar of perfume gives us a hint into the nature of our relationship with wealth. It is an instrument of worship, not an object of worship. That sounds very simplistic, but it's very profound. We are to see the things that God has given to us, the stuff, as not something that becomes a messiah to us, the source of life for us, the source of hope for us, the thing that we center our life around, but rather it has become something that is an instrument that we use to celebrate and express the real wealth in terms of our relationship with Christ. That's the message that comes from this passage. Then we observe the fact that this wealth is not only to be an instrument of worship, but it's an opportunity to respond to the cry of the poor. The fact that Jesus spends so much time with his attention and ministry given to not just the poor materially, but to those who are marginalized in society, the minority groups, the people that didn't count, that didn't have power, that basically were not given dignity in the system. He seems to center on these people. He came as one of them. He remained as one of them. He died as one of them. And he called his disciples basically to be among them. And he called as his disciples those who were among them. We talked about material poverty as being a representative of this in many ways. Material poverty is not just one of the things that erodes the dignity of humanity, but it certainly is one. And how the discrepancy between rich and poor on this planet is dramatic. 50% of the world's population lives on less than $2.50 a day. The remainder that live on more than $10 a day is relatively small, and we are way up here on the one edge of this. When you look at the distribution of wealth in America, the top 20% have 85% of the wealth. The top 1% has 43% of the wealth. The bottom 40% have only 0.3% of the wealth. The discrepancy here is dramatic. And of course, there are many repercussions here in terms of who counts as being really valuable, who has political clout, who has access to goods and services, so forth and so on. All of those things are indexed to access to material wealth. And that's why poverty becomes an important issue. It's not just the fact that people don't have the style of life they want. They don't have the opportunities or the contacts that their worth would suggest they deserve, in a sense. If we're made in the image of God, the Church of Jesus Christ is told to be very careful we don't make a distinction between the rich and the poor. Everyone bears the image of God, no matter what your status is in the world. That was a big point in Jesus' teaching and the apostles. We mentioned also last week that poverty is not just about material goods. Certainly, not having sufficient material goods to have a marginal amount of security, to be able to feed yourself and your family and shelter for yourself is an important issue. Most people in this country have enough materially to survive. The problem in our country is the distribution and the disequality in terms of how much stuff you have. But real poverty involves also social, political, and spiritual issues. Not being connected to a supportive community or a social structure of power. Not having freedom to affect change in one's situation. And spiritually, not having a meaning in life. Not being empowered from within with hope, dignity, and purpose from a relationship with God. Many of us grew up in humble circumstances physically, but we weren't poor. I always describe my upbringing as not poor at all, even though we would be classified poor this way. We had all of this, and that made a huge difference. This is why today poverty in the inner city is real poverty, because oftentimes not only do you have material deprivation, you have a social climate that's hostile, and you have no access to political power to change your situation, and oftentimes you're separated from a spiritual community. Those situations make poverty real poverty, a real slap in the face to the dignity of the image of God within us. In the Bible, care for the poor is framed in the context of justice and human dignity, more than just getting more stuff in the bank or more stuff in your pocket. Woe to those who make unjust laws. And here in Isaiah 10, he's speaking of the rulers of Israel. To those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights, and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. Here, it's the sense of justice and dignity that is the prophet's concern, not just how much money they have. Observation number three. Wealth is used to restore dignity to the poor by washing their feet. And in Mary's washing Jesus' feet, taking that wealth that she had access to and emptying it on his feet, she is sending a message not just about his burial and her thankfulness for healing Lazarus, but her recognition of the great dignity and significance of who this person is. And I'm going to suggest that when we think of our relationship ethically with respect to the things we have, one of the things that should be a part of our consideration is the fact that we start, as our first purpose, not just to satisfy ourselves, not just to bring equality economically to those around us, and especially to those who don't have, although that's part of it, but first and primarily is an act of worship and gratitude for what God has done. We are stewards and use our stewardship with respect to things to worship God. One of the many ways in which we worship God, we wash one another's feet as Jesus did his disciples. When Jesus washed the disciples' feet, he honored them by using his wealth as their Lord to include them in intimate fellowship with himself. And I'm going to argue, this is not said very often, but I think it's important in terms of the ethics of wealth. One of the greatest assets we have is not our wealth. It's the way we use our wealth and including others as a part of a respected, dignified community, as a part of our community. And one of the great insults, one of the great blasphemous misuses of wealth, even among Christians, is to basically do a drone strike on poverty. That is, fly over and drop a care package and never get boots on the ground. One of the things Jesus remarkably illustrates for us is the fact that he did not send money to the wealth, to the poor. He showed up for the poor. He became one with the poor. He basically gave himself to the poor. He gave hope to the poor. His disciples said to the man who was the beggar, poor, lame, silver and gold have we not, but what we have we give to you. And they grabbed his hand, and first of all says, they said, look me in the eye. And when he looked them in the eye, they grabbed his hand and said, we can't help you materially, but we can give you dignity and respect. We can give you life. And in doing that, a miracle takes place. He rises up and walks. Now really, the walking here was not the end all of the game. It was a dramatic symbol of the power they had to give something more than what he was expecting and what he was asking for. He commanded his disciples to do the same to each other. They were to wash one another's feet. Now, that it can be interpreted in several different ways. I'm going to suggest that one of the ways we understand the washing of the disciples' feet later in John is explained by its meaning in this context. It includes others in our intimate fellowship. It basically doesn't exclude, it includes. We do this when we use our material wealth, social position, listening ear, and caring touch to affirm the dignity of those who are vulnerable. The poor, the marginalized, the minority, so forth and so on. When we get face to face with them. One of the great travesties of our culture is the degree to which not only is wealth divided between a few and many, it's the way in which socially we're divided. Most of us, myself included, have a circle of friends who are not unlike me, economically, socially, educationally, so forth and so on. I look around this room. Most of us fall into a fairly narrow category. We're by and large employed, or have been employed. We're by and large well-educated. The average IQ in this room is far above average. If you've got a PhD in Chapel Hill in this church, no one knows it. We all assume that everyone either has one or is working on one. Kind of thing. There's no badge of honor in having a PhD. We just know that it just takes money and a lot of guts to get one. And you have to be marginally intelligent, but you don't really have to be that intelligent. You've got the money and the time. I'm just kidding, of course. We are superior to everybody else. but that's kind of the way the culture works. The sad thing is most of us do not have intimate relationships with people who are not like us. By intimate relationships, I mean close relationships. Foot-washing relationships. Not drone strike contacts, but boots on the ground contact. Leviticus 10:15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. Now here again, what the prophet is saying here is really important. Don't make a big deal of the poor just because they're poor. Justice is what we're after. We want to include the poor. Give them their rights. And in a culture, in every culture, especially in the ancient Near East and in our culture as well, it is so easy to forget that those who do not have material wealth also are deprived of almost everything else. They have their freedom, but they don't have access to the power to use it or to exercise it oftentimes. Some federally run welfare programs miss the point of the real need. We'll talk about this more next week. That is the dignity of the individual. They define the need as economic only. When you hear politicians talk about famine relief or poverty relief or poverty alleviation or dealing with the poor, it's almost always and only in terms of economic change, neglecting the social, political, and spiritual foundations of human dignity and community. That they encourage a culture of dependence rather than a culture of confidence, responsibility, and interdependence. In other words, if I say basically the only way you can be helped is by me giving you money, and you just have a charity case, what does that suggest to you or to me if I'm the recipient in terms of my dignity? It robs me of my dignity. It says basically I can't compete. It's basically I'm not worthy. I am a charity case. That does not help the poor. The poor's need is for affirmation and inclusion as a part of respectful society. And it creates an inefficient welfare system where much of the economic resources go to people who manage the system rather than to those who really need their help. Our oldest son, Daniel, is profoundly autistic, as some of you know. When I was on the advisory board for the governor's management of developmental disabilities several years ago, I had a chance to see the states working on the inside in terms of helping people like my son. And I was very, very discouraged. In the case of our son's care, $100,000 were going in the top of the chute just for his care from the state. $100,000. What came out was a small fraction of that he saw in terms of his care. The rest of it was chewed up in management, in lawyers, researchers, studies, bureaucrats, so forth and so on. And I said to myself, if that's true for this little program, what about all the other programs that are going on here? Very inefficient. And it's no wonder that people are frustrated and throwing their hands up in disgust with respect to the system. And we'll talk more about that next week. Observation number 4. Material wealth can be both a blessing and a challenge. Contrary to popular opinion, political left, the Bible teaches that material wealth is from God and is not evil. The problem is not wealthy people. The problem is people, not just wealthy people. Contrary to the popular opinion of the political right, the Bible teaches that those who have it did not earn it and should willfully share it. Now you're saying, yes, but. Now I'll repeat it as I said last week. Spend more time on your yes and less time on your but with that one. Listen to it. You didn't earn it. God gave it to you. Well, I worked hard for it. God gave you the family that raised you. God gave you your intelligence. God gave you your opportunity. You were not born in Saudi Arabia or in Sub-Saharan Africa. You were born in the United States of America. But North Carolina. North Carolina, Mississippi, I don't care. You've been given a gift. And what you have, you did not receive. God gave it to you. Get over it. It's not yours. The world is... It's not about you so much. And it's not yours. As a Christian, you gave it up. When you died, you gave up your toys. Now they become a part of your stewardship responsibility. They are not yours. Your children are not yours. Your things are not yours. They are things that become instruments of worship. 1 Timothy 6. This is the text for today. We finally got to the text. This class is starting right now. Paul is speaking of men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth, who suppress or suppose that godliness is a means of great gain, of gain. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith, piercing themselves with many a pang. And later he goes on in that same chapter, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. By the way, this is important. He says, the things that God has given us we are to enjoy, not despise, not only be afraid of, but to enjoy. Instruct them to do good and be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. In other words, if you want to find real life, it's not in more stuff. It's basically in the way you use your stuff, the way in which you manage it, so to speak. A purpose-driven sense of wealth. What does the Bible say about wealth? Well, basically three things. Enjoy it, share it, and beware of its dangers. You can divide the purpose of wealth into basically four things if you look at Scripture from Genesis to Revelation. First of all, it's a blessing from God. Be thankful for it. Don't despise it. Secondly, it's an opportunity for ministry. Be responsible with it. Don't basically hoard it for yourself. Thirdly, as a dangerous deception, don't let it define you. You don't keep score in the kingdom of God in terms of your wealth. Your goal is not to be the wealthiest person in the cemetery, to gather as much as you can during your life and then die rich. The world keeps score by where you are in the pecking order in terms of your wealth, by and large, not in the kingdom of God. And recognize that that wealth can be a desensitizer to God, people, and your spiritual needs. Don't let it blind you. And I'm going to suggest that as evangelical Christians, as disciples of Jesus Christ, most of us would say, okay, I get all that. What we don't realize is the degree to which we really are vulnerable to this. It's very easy for us to write a check for poverty relief to World Vision and not know anyone who's really poor. It's really easy for us to think that all the poor need is money. Let me tell you an experience last week that I had. I was driving to Home Depot to get insulation for pipes under our house. Stopped at the stop sign. And on 15501, there were all the panhandlers there with signs. Out of work, God bless, anything will help. I stopped, rolled down my window. One of the guys came over. He looked at me and he said, "Are you a pastor?" Do I look like a pastor? I said, "Yes." And he said, "Would you pray for me?" He said, "I'm discouraged." And before the light turned green, I reached out and prayed for him. And I said, "Lord," I didn't know this guy. I said, "Lord, lift this guy's heart, spirit. Refresh his mind. Give him hope." And the light turned green and I drove off. And I thought about that. I said, you know, it was good I rolled out my window. It was good I got his attention. It's good I listened to him. It was good he was able to share his heart with me. It's good I could pray with him. But it would have been much better if I had gone back and said, "Hey, are you hungry? Let's go talk. And I've done this before, picked people up, taken them to Panda Inn, and spent, in one case, 2 hours just hearing a guy's story. I said, tell me your story. I want to hear it. And I got an earful. I can talk to you about that sometime too. I learned a lot about what the culture of the panhandler is like. Not all of them are the same, but it's a world I didn't know anything about. And it's not what people perceive it to be. It's a real world where the real needs are not just material. They're deeper than that. They're needs for acceptance, needs for inclusion, needs for respect, so forth and so on. But the point is, it's so easy for us to be desensitized to all that because we have no contact with it. We our paths just don't cross that way. One of the I think very progressive and ingenious architectural plans for community development is seen in places like Southern Village. How many of you live in Southern Village? Some of you do. Southern Village is a concept that is really spreading throughout the country. And the idea is to, in large metropolitan areas, bring together communities that are made up of upper middle class and lower class housing, where there's a community within the community, where you have schools where children from the well-to-do and the not-so-well-to-do, the have-nots and the have-yots, get together for common social contact. They go to church together. There's a church in the community, a school in the community. They shop at the same stores, so forth and so on. The idea is to bring these people together at a time in our culture when technology is driving us apart. If you don't have an education and you can't run a computer, you can't get a job in many cases. You're separated. And the argument by many cultural prophets is that that's going to increase. There's going to be a segregation between those who are unable to operate the technology and those that can. The people that can operate the technology will make the money, and they will support, as welfare cases, those who cannot. I'm exaggerating that, of course, but that separation is something that we have to address as a reality that hurts us in so many ways. And the big one is this desensitization. We don't understand. We've never heard the story of someone who basically has lived on the other side of the tracks. John Wesley's dilemma. Many of you are disciples of John Wesley in the proper sense. John Wesley's dilemma was basically this. Poverty and humility become the seedbed of hunger for God and faith. Faith brings an enlightenment of basically how to behave, how to work, how to live. Religious revival takes place. That religious revival turns into industrious workers who are frugal in the way in which they handle things. They're good stewards. They become wealthy and powerful. And with that wealth and power, they develop pride and anger. Things not going their way. They can't control. And they lose their spiritual foundations. They are decayed and become separated from God. That further produces sloth and entitlement, and they become poor again. There's this vicious circle. And Wesley was saying, you know, I'm not sure helping the poor materially is very good, because it kills their appetite for the things of God. It was Moody who said, basically, he would go into the streets with bread in one hand and the Bible in the other. But eventually, he left the bread at home, because he found that many people would come for the bread and leave. That's our nature. But when I say that wealth is a mixed bag. It is a blessing and a curse. Poverty is not necessarily the worst thing that happens to us spiritually. Most of us came to Christ not on the mountaintop. We came after being in the valley, where the mountaintop was seen as the mountaintop. Generosity is not only about money, but about respect, caring, time, and interest, with an emphasis, I'm going to suggest, not on the money, but on respect, time, caring and interest, giving dignity to people. God's people are marked by three things in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. Their sense of justice, their hard work, and their generosity. As I think Charles Wesley said, my goal is to make as much money as I can, and to save as much money as I can, and to give as much money as I can. Let him who steals, steal no longer, but rather let him labor performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has need. This is the stewardship that Jesus fostered. Rule of engagement number one, with respect to rule of thumb number one, with respect to wealth. Remember that your greatest asset is not material. In dealing with poverty, it's not your stuff that is your greatest asset. Acts chapter 3, verses 6 and 7. Silver and gold have I none, but what I have, I will give to you. And seizing them by the hand, rise up and walk. The disciples basically were not equipped by Jesus with bags of money, even though his concern was for the poor. Jesus was not a social revolutionary in terms of changing the systems of government, even though his focus was on the poor. Now, if your focus is on the poor, and you're not equipping your disciples with money to hand out, and changing the government so it becomes more just, how do you understand poverty? You understand that poverty is more than just material. It's basically being marginalized. It's being robbed of your dignity. Rule thumb number two. Don't give money to people you don't know. Now, before you scratch your head and say, what in the world are you talking about? First, get to know them by giving them time, caring ear, and then consider other help. When God's Spirit prompts you to basically share, don't do a drone strike. Put boots on the ground. Get to know people that you share with. Many of us, myself included, have given lots of money to people who abused it. When I was a younger Christian, when people asked for things, I gave generously, only to find that I was being laughed at as they walked away, having scammed me. Now, I don't like to be scammed. I can take a lot of abuse. Scamming is something that really gets to me. But I've been scammed a lot. And I have my Christian friends who remind me to say, Jim, listen, it's better to be scammed than to be a Scrooge. And I think I would agree with that. Although, I don't give money to people I don't know anymore. Yes.
Poverty is a spirit as well. And many of the wealthy are...
Yes. Impoverished, of course. That's a very good point. I mean, part of what Jesus is saying here in respect to the nature of poverty can be seen in the fact that many people who have a lot of wealth are very lonely, very empty. Why would anyone commit suicide after winning the lottery? I mean, I just can't figure that out. When you understand human nature, it's not hard to figure out. Wealth just doesn't satisfy. I'm reminded of Princess Diana's quote that I've used before, where she says, "People say it's better to be happy and poor than rich and miserable. But how about a compromise of being moderately wealthy and moody?" And I think that's where most of us are. We don't want to necessarily be filthy rich as Christians. That looks too bad. We'd secretly like to, but we don't want to go there. But at the same time, we want to be comfortable enough that we basically don't have to have the cares of the poor on us. We want them out there. And we will write a check for Thanksgiving and Christmas. But then we'll feel good about ourselves. That lifestyle does not bring about the kind of inner fellowship, koinonia, that comes with foot washing. when we want to have fellowship with Jesus and experience the grace and the peace of God in our lives, that's not the way to experience it. That's not being close to Jesus. We get close to Him when we do the kind of things that we see exemplified in Mother Teresa. Now again, I'm not a fan of Mother Teresa's theology. There are a lot of things that I disagree with in terms of her theology. But boy, she's spot on in terms of her understanding of ministry. When she says, when she was asked basically why she got involved in social work, she said, I'm not involved in social work. I'm involved in worship. What I'm doing is not social work, it's worship. I'm serving Jesus. When I look into those eyes of people who are poor and forgotten, I'm looking into the eyes of Jesus. It was Jesus who said basically, I was hungry, you did not feed me. When did we not feed you or give you drink? And Jesus said in Matthew chapter 25, to the extent you did this to the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. Mother Teresa saw something there that evangelical Protestants say, huh? What's she talking about? We should immediately be convicted in our hearts that basically is what ministry and worship is all about. That's what wealth is all about. That's what basically a purpose-driven wealth leads to. It's basically an instrument of worship. Rule number three, be generous even when you have little to share materially. There's no excuse for not being generous. Wealth, or material wealth, is a gift from God. But generosity is not a gift. It's a sign. Generosity is a sign of which side you're on. Who you're a disciple of. Are you serving the Creator or the creation? Are you respecting in people the image of God? Or are you just basically looking for a communal society? Are you basically trying to relieve people's physical pain, social pain? Or are you trying to relieve a deeper pain, scratch a deeper itch in the human soul than that? And the generosity of what you have basically can be expressed by what you have. You don't have to have a lot of money to show up, to listen, to touch, to include, to give dignity to the people around you. That's basically all I've got to say. But now we can talk. Let me just share a couple stories before we go on to next week. If you want to get these slides, they're on this website. There was a woman that was a part of this congregation several years ago, and I'm embarrassed that I don't remember her name. I remember what she looked like. She was in her mid-60s. She was tall, statuesque, blonde, looked like a model. Her husband was a very successful businessman. They moved here as a part of his business. And they were here for just a few years, 3 years as I recall, in the church. She was one of these bubbly, vivacious Christians, you know, society types. And I rolled my eyes when I first met her. I said, oh boy. I said, how long are they going to last in this church? This is the church of retired hippies, you know, kind of thing. I was absolutely overwhelmed in being impressed with this woman. She had not been here more than 2 or 3 weeks, and she was in the back streets of Carrboro starting a Bible club for kids on the street. Now, if there's one place she didn't fit, that was it. That just wasn't her environment. But it was her environment. I checked her background. She'd done this wherever she'd gone. Gone after kids on the street. She started a Bible class, Bible club. Had kids memorizing scripture. Kids at first were reluctant, then they became fans and showed up, partially because of what she could do. She had contacts because of her status in society, whereby she could reward kids in special ways. One of the ways in which she rewarded them was this. You memorize 100 Bible verses, you get a free ride in an airplane. She had a friend who had an airplane, Horace Williams up here. And the kids got free rides flying over the Piedmont. These were project kids, if they memorized 100 verses. boy, did that ministry grow with kids. The point is this. Here was a person who put boots on the ground, eye-to-eye contact. The kids would have never remembered or even known anyone associated with a care package. Those kids who were a part of that ministry remembered her face. To this day, I suspect if we could find them, they'd remember her face. And they certainly remember the airplane ride. And hopefully the verses. And the message that those verses convey. But the point is this. It's that kind of face-to-face contact that really ministers to the poor. It was her, it was not just her material wealth. It was the wealth of her experience, the wealth of her position, the wealth of being a Christian, the wealth of allowing Christ's Spirit in her to come out. When Jesus talks about ministering to prisoners and to orphans and to widows, sometimes we get the impression that why would Jesus, or he asked the question, at least I have, asked the question, why would Jesus want to set the prisoners free? I mean, all we need is a lot of social paths running around the streets of our community who need to be in prison and separated from society. Why is Jesus concerned about ministering to prisoners? When you've worked in or with or around people who are part of a prison culture, you recognize how sterile that kind of culture oftentimes is with respect to love, community, dignity, respect, so forth and so on. If people do not have contact from those who are in loving, respectful, dignified communities coming in and touching, there's no light, or very little light. Jesus' concern is not basically we're filling our streets full of hardened criminals. It's for recognizing the dignity of human, of God's, of humanity by bearing God's image that exists among those who are forgotten in society. Those who are marginalized, those who are outside the mainstream, they need to see and hear and feel something of the dignity that comes of being made in God's image. And the only way that's going to happen for many of them is through contact from the outside. And this is why, and it's not just prisoners, it's the same is true with orphans and widows. You talk about insulting a person's soul, an orphan, being orphaned, has got to be really, really tough. I can't imagine what that's like. Some of you have been there. But I can't imagine growing up without parents, without the memories that I have of my mother and father being there at critical times in my life. What do you do when you don't have that? We've had people in our family who have been in that situation. They're very, very painful and difficult. And for the widow, losing a husband or losing a wife, very painful. Coming alongside people in their poverty, in their time of need, when their soul is being insulted by the circumstances of a broken world, that's when basically we have a purpose-driven wealth. That's when basically our wealth comes to be boots on the ground and really an act of worship for God. We'll talk more about that next week when we finish up this series on poverty. Now, observations you have, or maybe testimonies. Yes?
I think the main purpose of Christ's teaching is about relationship and not about money. Because everything he did was to encourage people to fellowship together.
Right, I
think. For example, he had his disciples together, and then he made them to go and see other people and fellowship with them.
Yeah, that the point that Jesus' ministry was basically drawing people to him and doing intimate fellowship with him is illustrated so often. It's not only washing their feet, which he did in John. But you think of the story of the prodigal son. The punchline of the prodigal son story, where he had basically taken his inheritance and wasted it on wild living and selfish living, and has brought back the climax of the story is the fellowship that exists between the father and the prodigal. The intimate fellowship. That's the reward. That's the final chapter in the book. It's this connectedness, being included, being given dignity again, putting the ring on his finger and the cloak on his back. His dignity is restored, in a sense, after he had failed miserably. Another example. When Jesus basically takes the woman who is caught in adultery, someone who basically has been trashed by her own deeds, her own hand, and now is ready to be crucified by the mob. Jesus comes, basically, and rescues her. Doesn't basically say that what she's done is okay. She says, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. He includes her. He gives her dignity back. He basically becomes a lifeline for her. You could go on and on in terms of Zacchaeus, the little man, who basically was overlooked by society. And he says, come down. Let me go to your house tonight and we'll dine together. This was the way Jesus responded to people. It was that the dignity that came with his touch, his gaze, his words, so forth and so on. He did not have a lot of money and didn't need it. Because what people really needed was more than money. When Satan tempts Jesus, and Jesus says basically to Satan, man cannot live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. He was not suggesting you don't need bread. But he was saying, bread is not enough. Bread will never satisfy the deepest longings in your soul. And in that respect, the words of God and the touch of God become absolutely indispensable, and that is something we all have. Yes?
There are two things I just really want to say. You talk about your own strikes. I can see how, sometimes Christians do that more to appease their own soul or kind of inflate themselves instead of glorifying God or whatever. But the other thing I was thinking of too is talking about spiritual poverty. I also suggest there's an increase in spiritual poverty today, the way that some churches' doctrines being changed or hijacked, or the way that forces people from their spiritual homes.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that, a lot of times in the church today, real insight into the nature of spiritual poverty is eroded by a church's emphasis in the wrong direction. And I'm thinking perhaps not of the same thing you're thinking of, but it's very easy for the church to reduce Christian ethics to economic relief and welfare. That misses the point. And that's part of... When we say that Christianity is largely, just like all the religions, help the poor by giving them money. That misses the point. But there are many other ways in which the church misses the point, too. It can basically, rather than helping the poor, throw them under the bus and say, if you would just shape up, or if we can hide you, we will glorify God. We glorify God by hiding the poor among us and shutting them up. I mean, tell me, that sounds a lot like Jesus. Not at all. The church should be a place, and one of the things that I really am excited about in terms of the Bible church, in terms of what it's doing now, is it's purposefully reaching out to poor communities. Now, we need to do more than that, but I think we're putting boots on the ground in some respects with communities around the world and in this area. I'm thinking of Louise Rutebush. I mentioned her. Rutebush, right. I've got Agape Corn. We were over for dinner at her house a week or so ago. Here's a woman who basically did not grow up in poverty, but basically has spent her life in East Durham with street kids and given her life to live in an unsafe part of town to help kids. And God has mightily used her. Powerful story of someone who didn't have to do that, but basically gave herself. And this is
we can go on and on. There are lots of examples, many of them in this room. And some of you have been there, and on both sides of things like that.
One of the, today is Sanctity of Life Sunday, and one of the ministries that this church supports is Pregnancy Support Services, which many of these women are feel alone. They're abandoned by their family because they're pregnant. Their boyfriend or husband is pushing them to have an abortion. And that's one of the ministries of Pregnancy Support Services. It offers emotional, spiritual ministry to these women.
Next week we'll talk about poverty and policy.
Okay.